Great. Thank you, Cliff, and thanks to both Cliff and John for their elegant organization of the workshop. I guess first I should highlight a few disappointments that I have to offer at the outset. The first is language. I will be speaking in English. That is a failure of mine I've yet to overcome. The second is a lack of a PowerPoint, which at the end of a day, a long day of papers, is, I think, makes a talk somewhat more taxing. So thank you for your patience in advance. The material did not lend itself well to existing repertoire of images that I had access to. The third disappointment is somewhat more significant. It's the title. I couldn't deliver everything I'd promised in the title. So it's modified from speaking of the accommodation of Greco-Roman and South Asian thought in general to a cosmopolitan court, the confrontation of incommensurable cosmologies in late Sasanian political culture. What I have in mind there is the incorporation or integration of a particular body of Greco-Roman thought, namely Christian theology, into Iranian political culture. So only one form of knowledge, not quite as broad as the initial language would have suggested. The papers today have drawn our attention in very different ways to the acceleration of trans-regional and trans-cultural exchange in the first millennium. My interest here in this paper is in the problem that the circulation of novel ideas, texts, and cosmologies posed to the maintenance of political authority, particularly in Iran. And I will first set Iran against the backdrop of cultures in motion in late antiquity before turning to an argument concerning the adoption or innovation of a new technology of communication, namely the disputation, as a means of addressing or managing the dilemmas and ideological disequilibria that the rise of Christianity in a Zoroastrian empire provoked. The Iranian empire integrated the various cultures of the Near East, from the Euphrates to the Oxus, in a cosmopolitan political culture in late antiquity, 226 to 636 CE. More than simply an effect of the diversity of Iranian territories, cosmopolitanism, here defined as the capacity easily to cross cultural boundaries and to speak in a variety of idioms, served as an instrument of rule, a complex of practices that enabled the imperial elite to establish its cultural superiority and universalist authority. In an era of the heightened flow of texts, ideas, and objects between Eurasian regions. In late antiquity, the proliferation of religious communities with clearly defined doctrines, boundaries, and identities, most notably Manichaeism, Christianity, and Rabbinic Judaism, challenged the position of the Iranian ruling class that depended on the Zoroastrian religion, in particular, as the source of its ideological and infrastructural power. Of the various religious leaders who challenged Zoroastrian supremacy in late antiquity, Christian bishops and monks most articulately antagonized the imperial religion and most effectively organized communities in strategic regions, such as northern Mesopotamia, Armenia, and northeastern Arabia. Christian aristocrats in these regions had become indispensable to the fiscal and military administration of the empire before the end of the 6th century. But their religious leaders advocated militantly monotheistic beliefs and often adopted uncompromising positions vis-a-vis religious others. In the process of integrating its provincial elites, the Iranian court thus confronted the irreconcilable worldviews rooted in distinct cosmologies and rationalities of two world religions. The name of the Iranian empire had announced a cosmopolitan project already at the beginning of the empire in the middle of the third century, early third century. Iran Shah, the so-called territory of the air, or as a shorthand, I will use Iranian as a translation for the Middle Persian term air. United in their Zoroastrianism, the various aristocratic houses of the Iranian plateau formed an ethno-class of Iranians, or Iran, that conceived of itself as genealogically intertwined and constituted the dominant ruling elite throughout the provinces of the empire. But they ruled not only Iran, but also non-Iran, that is, they claimed to encompass within their realm all known territories across the globe. That is, there is a claim to universal sovereignty implicit in this claim to rule Iran Shah, for reasons that have to do with Zoroastrian cosmology that I won't elaborate on further at this moment. The Iranians claimed, in the heyday of Eurasian exchange, to have subordinated the polities and peoples of the world, and, still more boldly, to possess the capacity to reunify the world's knowledge, all of its art, all of its literature, all of its sciences. The Iranian court, from its inception, engaged in the selective appropriation of objects and ideas from non-Iran, deriving ultimately from the mythical Iranian kingdom that had unified humanity. Roman, Chinese, and Indian civilizations were believed to have possessed civilizational goods of their own, distinctly unlike the nomadic Huns, Turks, and Arabs, who were thought to be devoid of civilization, devoid of writing, devoid of art, devoid of anything worth appropriating on the part of the Iranians. In the domain of ideas, Alexander was believed to have scattered Iranian texts and knowledge in the course of his conquest of the Achaemenian Empire, and to have led, basically to have caused all knowledge that had originally been unified in Iran to be scattered across the world, but most particularly in East Asia, South Asia, and the Mediterranean. According to the fourth book of the Dengard, a 9th century compendium of Zoroastrian cosmological texts, the second king of kings, Shapur I, who reigns from 241 to 271, had begun the process of returning the world's knowledge to Iran only a few decades after the commencement of the empire. To quote from the text, Shapur I collected the non-religious writings on medicine, astronomy, movement, time, space, substance, accident, becoming, decay, transformation, logic, and other crafts and skills, which had been dispersed throughout India, Rome, and other lands, and collated them with the Avesta, and commanded that a copy be made of all those writings that were flawless and to have them deposited in the royal treasury. What merits emphasis here in a text that captures the aspirations of the 6th century Sasanian court, not the 3rd century court of Shapur I, is the idea that Roman and Indian sciences could be, quote, collated with the Avesta, that is, married with Zoroastrian religious thought. Because Ormazd, the supreme benevolent deity in Zoroastrianism, was believed to be the source of all knowledge, and the Avesta was his primary vehicle for the dissemination of knowledge, Zoroastrianism necessarily encompassed all truths, scientific, philosophical, artistic, and religious, even if they were found far from Iran itself. As the representatives of Ormazd on Earth, the kings of kings were to preside over the reunification of knowledge and its collation with the existing body of Zoroastrian thought. It was a 6th century empire that regularly exchanged diplomats with Rome and China, dominated the Indian Ocean trade, and expanded in the four cardinal directions simultaneously that actually sought to realize the unification that Dengard had envisioned. The court of Khusrau I, reigns from 531 to 579, actively, even strenuously worked to return the sciences of India and Rome, in particular, to Iran. Under his patronage, the physician Borzoi traveled to India and brought back a copy of the Panchatantra, and then translated the text from Sanskrit into Middle Persian, whence the Syriac and Arab, ultimately the Arabic versions, were derived. A collection of astronomical texts was also translated from Sanskrit at the court in the year 556, and these known instances of translation are likely only a fraction of the textual sharing between Iran and South Asia that took place via Bactrian intermediaries as well as through direct contacts like the physician Borzoi in the 6th century, a process that would continue in the first two centuries of Islamic rule, particularly the first century of the Abbasids. The Neoplatonist philosophers Damasius, Simplicius, and their associates fled a Roman Empire increasingly inhospitable for non-Christian thinkers to the court of Khusrau I in 531 on the strength of the reputation of the King of Kings for sponsoring philosophical study and the translation of texts from, in this case, Greek into Middle Persian and Syriac. Imperial investment in scholarship foreshadowed the cosmopolitan practices to which the universalist imperial ideology of Iran would give rise. The appropriation of outside learning is not in itself cosmopolitan in my definition. For the reception of Roman philosophers and the translation of Indian astronomical or literary texts did not directly facilitate the participation of culturally distinct elites in a common political culture. Neither Romans nor Indians were integrated into Iranian political networks or institutions. The discrepancies of their worldviews could thus go unnoticed or ignored in quotidian elite interactions, and there was no political urgency to resolve their contradictions. To adopt the argument of Bruno Latour, the test of the viability of a cosmopolitanism is its capacity to facilitate the inclusion of persons with at least potentially contradictory worldviews in its framework. Cosmopolitanism, in this sense, becomes an instrument through which imperial networks can be constructed and maintained instead of a mere aesthetic. The Christian beliefs of Iran's local elites were thus the test of its cosmopolitan pretensions. For Zoroastrians claiming to encompass all bodies of knowledge, the presence of an articulate, highly literate class of religious specialists, often well-versed in Greco-Roman philosophy and invariably hostile towards Zoroastrian beliefs within the empire, and even at court, posed an obvious challenge. When the Sasanians initially brought bishops into power, they seemed to have been scarcely aware of the complexities of Christian doctrine or its hostility toward other religions. They seem, quite frankly, pretty clueless about Christian beliefs. The first royal initiatives to investigate Christian beliefs come at the end of the 5th century, that is, more than a century after the initial inclusion of bishops into imperial networks and giving them a presence at, or positions at court. So it takes about a century for the Sasanians to realize how complicated and potentially challenging Christian thought is to their own ideological framework. The immediate context for this initial inquiry into doctrine was the controversy within Christian communities concerning the nature of Christ following the Council of Chalcedon in 451. And I think all of you will be pleased to know that I'm not going to offer a review of the doctrinal debates at stake. A well-known West Syrian polemicist, Simeon of Beit Arsham, challenged the Bishop of Seleucia Ctesiphon, that is the leading bishop in the Iranian Empire, to a public debate around the year 500. The questions under discussion were sufficiently unsettling for a Marzban, a frontier military commander, so one of the most important military positions in the empire, to have acted as the mediator for the disputation. The proliferation of controversies among Christians compelled the court increasingly to take an interest in their doctrines in the course of the 6th century. In keeping with the scholarly tendencies that would characterize the reigns of his successors, Qawad I reportedly commanded that every religion in the empire produce a written statement of its beliefs for presentation to the King of Kings in the last decade of the 5th century, a written statement that would then be translated from either Greek or Syriac into Middle Persian for storage in a royal archive, as well as evaluation on the part of the King of Kings and his associates. The collection and translation of Christian texts gave the court access to the thought of East and West Syrian Christians, but only heightened awareness of the ideological challenge this antagonistic religion posed to the Zoroastrianism on which imperial authority was predicated. Unlike Roman or Indian philosophies, Christian truths could not easily be collated with the Zoroastrian Avesta. The encounter with universalist monotheism led the court to adopt a novel cosmopolitan technique, the disputation. Qawad's successor, Husra I, went beyond the mere compiling of religious doctrines to organize debates of their contents, public debates of their contents. Where the early Sasanians had established religious truths and the supremacy of Zoroastrian doctrine through ordeals, of fire, water, or molten metals, that is, supernatural processes through which the truth value of doctrinal claims was evaluated. Their 6th century successors enthusiastically adopted the Greco-Roman practice of the disputation in place of the ordeal. And we often see in texts this transition specifically happening. So in one case in the middle of the 6th century, We have a Zoroastrian ordeal that is immediately followed by a disputation. There's a sort of, it becomes clear that the disputation is what replaces the ordeal at the instigation of the court. In the Sirat Anushirvan, the autobiographical account of Khusraw I, the King of Kings learned of certain nobles whose religion was opposed to what we inherited from our prophet. Instead of violently repressing these deviants, something Khusraw I had no problem doing in other contexts, he invited them to a hearing at court. Again, a quote from the text, "I had those of contrary opinions brought into my presence and commanded that they dispute until they arrived at the truth." The account of the Sirat Anushirvan finds confirmation in narratives of disputations between Christians and Zoroastrians and between East and West Syrian Christians that took place at the court of Khusraw I. According to the Roman West Syrian historian John of Ephesus, the King of Kings ordered bishops from the two Christian sects to come and debate with one another in his presence concerning their faith, so that he too would comprehend and examine what they discussed, evaluate their words, and determine which of them were rational. This is a highly idealized, stylized representation of the King of Kings on the part of a West Syrian who is deeply unsatisfied with the behavior of the Roman emperors in Constantinople, who, of course, did not accept the doctrinal claims of the West Syrians. So this is a purposeful idealization of the way a Sasanian would behave. Nevertheless, he was right to stress the importance Khusraw I ascribed to rational argumentation as an instrument through which the adherents of seemingly incompatible schools of thought could collaboratively seek the truth. The practice of disputation was among the cultural goods imported from the Mediterranean in the course of the Sasanian period. Things like mosaics, Neoplatonist philosophy, Galen, a variety of Roman arts. I could go on and on, I won't. Disputation is one of these goods that's imported from the Mediterranean world. Once thought to have declined with the rise of Christian orthodoxies that the Roman state enforced, disputations proliferated throughout the 5th, 6th, and 7th century Christian Roman Empire, albeit always in a form that took the fundamentals of the Council of Nicaea as its starting point. So these were not the freewheeling disputations of earlier Roman centuries. They were disputations intended to arrive at orthodoxy. The Chalcedonian controversies gave rise to a culture of public disputation between representatives of Diophysite and Miaphysite orthodoxies that spanned imperial frontiers, and the Iranian court likely first became familiar with the practice through such Christian intermediaries. To appropriate the practice for their own purposes, however, the late Sasanians sought out specialized knowledge of its workings. The above-mentioned philosopher Paul the Persian, actually I haven't yet mentioned Paul the Persian, sorry, it's an earlier draft of this paper. Paul the Persian composed a work on dialectics known as the Treatise on the Logic of Aristotle, on behalf of Khusraw I, as an introduction to rational dialectical argumentation. The expectation that Christian Zoroastrian encounters should take place according to shared rules and rational principles appears even in a Christian text from late 6th century northern Mesopotamia. Here the disputation took place not in the presence of a King of Kings, but rather in the presence of a local aristocrat on the polo field, the sort of characteristic site of elite otium in the Iranian world. The inclusion of such a disputation in a provincial hagiographical work shows how common dialectics had become in the late Sasanian period as a means of framing interreligious encounters. Even the aristocratic audience of the comparatively humble city of Arbela in northern Mesopotamia, very distant from the intellectual life of the court, could recognize the rules of disputation and, more importantly, the authoritative status of the disputation as a means of arriving at shared truths. From the Roman perspective, disputations critical of religious truths became a signature of Iranian political culture. According to an account known as the Religious Controversy at the Sasanian Court, the Religionsgespräch, a Greek text composed in Roman Syria in the 6th century, the Iranian court hosted a freewheeling disputation between Christians, Jews, and polytheists that involved a wide range of texts and ideas the contemporary Roman court would have regarded as heretical and therefore as illicit. As Hubert Janjic has recently observed, the account is unprecedented in Roman literature, more particularly in Christian Roman literature. One of its characters, Aphroditean, adopted a rational, skeptical middle path, transcending the particularities of Greco-Roman polytheism and Christianity. And the disputation in the text aimed at the mutual recognition of shared truths rather than the vindication of a single orthodoxy. Even if himself a Roman Christian, the anonymous author recognized the greater openness of Iranian disputational culture in locating this imagined debate at the court of the Sasanians. Such a portrayal of the Iranian court was not without foundation. There are at least two known leading intellectuals in the 6th century who abrogated religion entirely in favor of philosophical skepticism, not unlike Aphroditean in the religious controversy at the Sasanian court. Borzoi, the translator of the Panchatantra that I already mentioned, and Paul the Persian, whom I also have mentioned, the translator of Aristotle's Logic on behalf of Husserl the First. Both of these are supposed to have embraced philosophical skepticism that is portrayed as transcending the particularities of religion. So it's not expressed polemically against Christianity or Zoroastrianism, but rather a superior rational truth that can encompass the particularities of religion. Their responses were nevertheless exceptional. The disputations tended, on the contrary, to reinforce the position of existing religions by means of conclusions that emphasized shared beliefs of the kind the Roman observer of Iranian disputational culture described. The aforementioned Christian narratives of the disputations uniformly presented their own parties, whether East or West Syrian, as the victors in what were willful misrepresentations of the events. Not surprising, there are relatively few Christian narratives that present them as losers, regardless of the genre. They could claim victory because Iranian disputations were left open-ended. If Greco-Roman debates generally concluded with clear winners and losers, controversies at the Iranian court came to a close with the word of the King of Kings or another political authority appointed as the mediator of the disputation. The Abbasid debates that were based on Iranian models evinced a similar ambiguity. In cases where accounts from the different religious groups party to a debate have survived, each claimed victory for itself. The Iranian court adopted the disputation from the Romans, but innovated a novel structure that allowed competing parties to present and to debate their beliefs without resolving their contradictions. This reworked disputation came to showcase the universal knowledge of the court. If the original function of religious disputation was, in the words of John of Ephesus, to gain understanding of different beliefs, this gave way to another priority, demonstrating the capacity of the King of Kings, and by extension the Iranian ethnoclass as a whole, to comprehend the views of the various schools of thought within the empire, and to select the components of their ideologies they deemed meritorious and or compatible with the imperial religion, Zoroastrianism. The artfully orchestrated ambiguity of the disputation allowed ecclesiastical leaders to depart from the court claiming that the King of Kings himself had recognized the truth of their religion, while the supremacy of Zoroastrianism remained unchallenged. In pursuing shared truths in the manner of the religious controversy at the Sasanian court, the disputation functioned to maintain the superior position of a Zoroastrianism that now faced an articulate opposition within the ranks of the imperial elite. The court accordingly placed an emphasis on the banal essentials of religion without any intention of reconciling the incompatibilities. The only surviving Middle Persian record of a disputation shows how Zoroastrians regarded the institution as another means of communicating their own unimpeachable intellectual superiority. In this account, the intellectual tendencies of the 6th century court were projected into the 4th century, the era of a legendary Mobed, a sort of the chief priest in Zoroastrianism, and a scholar, Mobed and scholar, Zoroastrian priest scholars, is sort of the term I usually use, Adurbad-i-Mahrasbandan. better known in Zoroastrian literature for his participation in miraculous ordeals traditionally used to conduct religious controversies before the introduction of the disputation, he appears here reinvented as the impresario of the debate between himself and scholars from Rome and India concerning the nature of good and evil. The questions and answers recorded were, according to their editor, yes, Asmussen, entirely lacking in originality. This is one of the most boring texts in Middle Persian literature, if not the most boring text in Middle Persian literature, and I argue that its boredom is purposeful. The good here constituted unchallenged rulership for the Romans, wealth for the Indians, and the state of being without fear for the Iranians. The disputation resulted in a collection of gnomic banalities that nearly any ancient person could have pronounced. Anyone can talk about how important good rulership, wealth, and the state of being without fear are. With an insistence on the parties professing to shared truths, however banal, the text is diametrically opposed to Christian narratives of disputational triumph. The scholars who composed and preserved this account regarded superficial commonalities as evidence of Zoroastrian universalism, of the religion's capacity to integrate the true elements of foreign ideologies. A collection of ethical truisms was used to demonstrate that Romans and Indians acknowledged the supremacy of the integrative truth of Zoroastrianism. Beyond the substantive knowledge of religions and sciences the late Sasanian court had acquired through this institution, the disputation served to safeguard the imperial religion from the omnipresent intellectual challenges that the heightened trans-regional traffic in texts and ideas posed to its standing, and perhaps more importantly, to subordinate the rival systems of belief proliferating in the empire. Iranian cosmopolitanism depended on the illusion that Zoroastrianism could encompass all bodies of knowledge, and the disputation provided the underpinnings of such an illusion through the securing of assent to the superior position of Zoroastrian rulers as adjudicators and through the production of banalities as stable points of commonality. The notion of a multi-layered, multifaceted religion was well-rooted in Zoroastrian thought. As a complete body of cosmological and ritual knowledge, the so-called good religion was beyond debate, beyond words, and beyond the particularities of other religions. Its solid core, the Avesta, was believed to have stand within a seven-walled fortress that even the most learned of Zoroastrians could not penetrate. In other words, the religion in its entirety was the preserve of the scholars, members of the major ruling aristocratic houses, those who had studied the Avesta and its exegesis extensively. The great bulk of Zoroastrians were discouraged from acquiring knowledge of the core of religion that resided beyond rational inquiry. According to one scholar, the intelligence of humanity consisted of 30 seeds, but this one seed is of least consequence, that by which one ought to learn the Avesta. So believers are discouraged from gaining the specialized learning of the religion. The metaphor of the seeds simultaneously underlined the diffuse state of knowledge that had been scattered among humanity. And only the select few, the Iranian elite, were in possession of the Avestan seed, as well as the 29 other seeds that had been scattered throughout the world. The foundation of true religion was therefore located in an impenetrable domain, a seven-walled fortress, humans could not access through reason. A theory that allowed Zoroastrians to compare various aspects of their religion without subjecting its essentials, its fortified core, to criticism. The Iranian disputations therefore entailed the concealing of beliefs as well as their unveiling. If the court fostered interreligious debates on the basis of logical reasoning, its efforts were ultimately directed at bolstering the position of Zoroastrianism rather than acknowledging the truths of other religions. The Zoroastrian approach to Christianity thus prefigures modern constructions of world religions, in which 19th and early 20th century scholars selectively compared aspects of Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Jainism, and Buddhism and other religions in order to re-articulate, consciously or unconsciously, the superior standing of Western Christianity, however secularized its form, in the guise of a cosmopolitan pluralism. At the Iranian court, Christian sects and perhaps other religions were examined, debated, and evaluated in pursuit of aspects compatible with Zoroastrianism. These were likely as banal as the verities outer body Mahasbandhan was believed to have extracted from the Indian and Roman philosophers, or as the 19th century tropes of Eastern religious wisdom. But their potency may have derived precisely from this banality, the readiness of Zoroastrian and Christian elites alike to profess commonalities that posed no threat to the respective cores of their beliefs. The kings of kings, Kavad, Khusrau I, and Khusrau II, could affirm the merits of Christian doctrine in such a way that East and West Syrian Christians could both claim royal sanction for their creeds without compromising the good religion concealed behind its seven-walled fortress. The collection of statements of Christian doctrine, moreover, served to place the court in a position of authority over Christians' own bodies of knowledge, much like the Roman emperors in Constantinople. And the different Christian sects continued to compete for royal recognition as the widely recognized validation of truth, even among the Christians of the empire. In the early 7th century, after the conquest of the Roman Near East, the King of Kings came to occupy the role of arbiter of Christian orthodoxy that the Roman emperor had once occupied. And East and West Syrian bishops both readily acknowledged Khusrau II as the guardian not only of their churches, but also of their doctrines. Defined as a discrete entity subordinate to the court, the rival universalism of Christianity came to complement, rather than undermine, the universalist project of Iran. East and West Syrian churches became religions of the empire, but in positions subordinate to the good religion. The Iranian court sought to realize its cosmopolitan claims in the face of strident literary cultures that contested its maintenance of superior, all-encompassing knowledge. Encounters with Roman, Indian, and Christian intellectual cultures resulted in efforts to translate their literatures, to draw insights from their learning, and ultimately to reunite human knowledge. Christianity posed a special challenge with its own cosmopolitan aspirations and inveterate hostility toward rival systems of belief. And yet the court successfully gathered knowledge of its doctrines and in the process disciplined its representatives, placing them and their knowledge in subordinate relations. Iranian cosmopolitan elites stood above the particularities of Christianity as well as above Roman and Indian sciences and located themselves as the organizers and superintendents of civilization. Their interest in other cultures was not a benign proto-multiculturalism, but an instrument of power. Only an Iranian could look down onto the world's cultures, pick and choose among them, and assemble a new mosaic appropriate for their political circumstances. As their superiority resided in a religious knowledge beyond the reach of the non-Iranians, even such a contradictory body of knowledge such as Christianity could be placed within the imperial order without challenging Zoroastrian preeminence. The religious disputation was an institution designed to facilitate not the exchange of ideas, but the recognition of difference, of a bounded cultural entity. The cosmopolitan Mobed priest-scholars, Marzban military commanders, and kings of kings, who stood above and beyond human particularities, could call into being clearly defined groups subordinated to themselves. In inviting and attending Christian declarations of belief, they made themselves the authorities behind the definition of Christian identities. This was pointedly communicated through the preservation of written statements of belief in the royal archives. Through such cosmopolitan acts, Christians and other groups came to imagine highly contradictory, rationally incommensurable cultures as interdependent and themselves as dependent on the authority of a Zoroastrian imperial apparatus. That is, in professing their doctrine, Christians are simultaneously acknowledging the authority of a Zoroastrian imperial apparatus on the basis of which those doctrines were true. The power of Iranian cosmopolitanism resided in its ability to have Christians accept these subordinate positions for themselves in the very act of articulating their beliefs. The successful practice of cosmopolitanism, I argue by way of conclusion as we near six, was necessary for the maintenance of the position of a ruling elite that crisscrossed religions, languages, and ethical orders, as well as territorial regions. The Zoroastrian-Iranian ethnoclass that took shape in the 3rd century initially regarded its position of universal rulership as self-evident. The Iranians had, after all, definitively subjugated the Romans and established their hegemony across the Near East. By the 6th century, they could claim to be regularly receiving envoys acknowledging their sovereignty from China, Rome, and India. Although the occasional religious deviant, such as the prophet Mani, challenged Zoroastrian doctrines at court, no movement jeopardized the authority or integrity of the early Sasanian ruling elite. The rise of Christianity in the 4th through 7th centuries, however, confronted the court and aristocracy with a more pressing provocation. It was not only the polemical practices of ecclesiastical leaders, but also the political indispensability of the Christian secular elite that made the religion potentially corrosive to the aristocratic networks through which the court governed. As Iranians sought to rule regions such as northern Mesopotamia, Caucasus, and Arabia that I've mentioned, whose landowning aristocracies were largely Christian, the necessity of defining the relationship of the Zoroastrian Iranians to Christian local elites became plain. The initial use of violence gave way to patronage in the early 5th century as a means of ensuring Christian discipline. But the inherent irreconcilability of these two cosmologies remained. The growing importance of Christian aristocrats as officials, military commanders, and cavalrymen stimulated the court to innovate cosmopolitan practices that preserved its universal political order while overcoming the differences that threatened to break the ties binding its religiously disparate elites. One such practice was patronage, another was the disputation. The polemical assaults of ecclesiastical leaders against Zoroastrianism, and here I should mention that almost the entire corpus of Christian literature emerging from Iran is polemical in intention and conception, the disputation deprived such polemical attacks of their potency. You could attack Zoroastrianism all you like. Your doctrines, nevertheless, are true because of the recognition that the Iranian court, Zoroastrian court, gave them. Even as bishops and monks continued to rail against the good religion, Christian aristocrats could view the Iranians as a benevolent ethnoclass that recognized their religious legitimacy without denying their own religion. The disputation thus served, in conjunction with the other institutions of Iranian political culture, to bind Christian local elites into a transregional network, offering them access to a share in the rents of empire while reinforcing the position of the Iranians, the upper stratum of a hierarchically differentiated elite that had created Iran in its own service. Thank you.